Thank you so much, Rishus, the Rabbanim, Rabbi Willick, Rabbi Reese, the Rabbanim, my mother, my father-in-law. Thank you so much. Can you hear? Thank you so much, Rabbi Turk, and thank you so much, Ms. Susan Wexner, for everything, for your generosity, for your creativity, for your initiative, and for your continued devotion to the Wexner Kollel Elyon, to Yeshiva University. The Kollel has done so much for me personally and for Yeshiva University and has been a gift not only to Yeshiva, but to the entire Jewish world and beyond. And we are so grateful. We are all the beneficiaries, and it's a profound privilege for me to be able to be here tonight to give honor to your grandparents, to Harry and Lena Kabakoff, who, as we heard, were paragons of kindness and hospitality, and as such, upheld the noblest traditions of the founding father of the Jewish people, of Abraham, of Avram Avinu, who, through such behavior, earned his status as the founder of the Jewish people. That's what the Torah tells us explicitly, after describing an extraordinary episode of his hospitality in great detail, that it's because of such kindness, taking care of those in need, that is how he earned that title. Immediately after that description, the Torah tells us that God declares that it's because of that that I have selected him, because he will teach his family and his descendants in such a fashion, to treat people this way, to take care of the needy. That's why he is going to lead the entire new nation that will be the Jewish people. And the story that the Torah describes there, which leads up to this selection, is a fascinating story, but the truth is there's a problem. If we look at the entire story all the way to the end, especially with the way the Talmud fills in the details, there's actually a bit of a problem. Let's go through the story together with the Talmudic details. We're told that here, Avram, before he engages in this hospitality, is actually recovering from his surgery. He's recuperating. He just had his circumcision, his bris milah, at an advanced age, and he's trying to recuperate. And God decides he should have a day off. He should be able to relax a little bit. So he arranges that it should be a very hot day, because normally Avram would extend himself in hospitality, would take care of all the travelers, would attend to the needs of anyone who was passing by. So in order to make sure he should have one day off, so God made sure it was a very hot day, so there wouldn't be anyone on the road. Therefore, Avram was alone, and God comes to visit him, to model another act of kindness, of chesed, bikur cholim, visiting the sick. And a part of that mitzvah is to see what does the patient need. Perhaps he needs chicken soup, ice cream. My father, Zichrono Livracha, always would come to the hospital and ask, what flavor ice cream does the patient need? So Avram, what do you need? Ice cream, chicken soup. Avram says, I don't want chicken soup, I don't want ice cream. I'm all about chesed. I'm all about kindness. I'm miserable here without anyone to take care of. I need visitors. I need to extend some hospitality. So God says, fine. And before the conversation is even over, three guests appear. And Avram has been able to take care of them, and he does in grand style. The Torah goes into tremendous detail about how he attends to their every need. And it's because of that, indeed, that we're told, yes, he will be selected as the ancestor of the Jewish people. But there's a problem. There's something about the story that doesn't quite work. And consider, to understand the problem, consider the following example. Rosh Hashanah is coming up. I give you all a blessing. You should be blessed with success beyond your wildest dreams. So imagine you all become incredibly wealthy, and you want to share the wealth. You all want to become tremendous philanthropists. So you want to give charitable donations in the most effective way possible. But you're very busy managing all of this new wealth. So you need some help to figure out how can you do the most good. So you hire an assistant, we'll call him Jeeves, and you ask Jeeves, please find me the best possible recipients for my new charitable donations. Very soon after, Jeeves comes, and it seems like he's actually found the best possible candidate. He's standing next to someone who seems incredibly needy, as if he doesn't have a cent to his name. He's totally bedraggled. His clothes are torn. He looks as if he hasn't eaten in a month. You're very happy with his selection. You reach into your desk. You take out a suitcase full of money. You hand it over to this person. He looks like he's going to cry. He's so happy. He hugs you. He walks away with the money. You are ecstatic. The fantastic choice. A few minutes later, you look out your window, and you see there's this guy shaking hands with Jeeves. He's not wearing the same clothes anymore. He's wearing fancy clothes. And he gets into what looks like a very expensive car, and he drives off. You call up Jeeves, and you say, Jeeves, what's going on? I just saw that guy. He didn't look the same as he did a few minutes ago. And Jeeves explains, oh, yeah, he's an actor. He's not really poor at all, and I hired him to pretend to be poor because you were looking for somebody to feel good with your donation. So I had him come in and dress up that way, and you felt good, right? I did a good job. I found a good actor. So are you happy? How quickly do you fire Jeeves? What is your reaction to this? How angry would you be? So what's the difference between what happens in that story and what happened with Avram Avinu? Avram Avinu says to God, I need to take care of some needy guests. And these visitors show up. He extends himself, spends time and money. It's a very elaborate, expensive meal that he provides for these visitors. And who are they? They're angels. They have no human needs. They're no different than actors. What's different about this situation than what I just described? If you fire Jeeves, so why isn't Avram equally upset about what happened with his request? So it seems, because indeed he's not upset, and this reaction is what earns him his place in history. And out of all of a lifetime of chesed, it's this episode specifically, where we're told he's the one, he's our ancestor. So what's going on here? There are some who explain that, yes, it's true, Avram, of course, wants to help people who are actually needy. But that wasn't his only motivation. Chesed, acts of kindness, are there to help people in need. That's very important. But Avram tapped into something else as well. In addition to the commandments of tzedakah, of yahav t'lerecha kamocha, of helping those who are suffering, there's also a notion of the halachta bedracha. At least 8 times in the Torah, we're told that we are meant to imitate God, imitatio Dei, for those who speak more Latin than English. So what does that mean, to imitate God? We don't have the same skill set. How do we follow in his path? So the Talmud tells us that most prominently it means that we should engage in acts of kindness. And this is something that Avram caught on to long before, that he recognized that God is about giving, is about kindness. And the more he developed this attribute, the more divine he would be. And the more he would enhance that aspect of his character. So every time he took care of people, he was furthering that goal of making himself more divine and more godly. And he was doing that at the same time as he was attending to the needs of people. So if there were those who were actually needy, terrific, he could do both. But if there was no one on the road who needed anything, he still wanted to make sure he could continue to develop his character. So he asked God, if there's nobody who needs anything, at least I need a workout. I need an exercise partner. So provide me with today's lesson so I can continue to work on myself, I can continue to develop this character, and I can further my goal of becoming more godly. And this is evocative of a statement of the Rambam of Maimonides, which is widely quoted. The Rambam, in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, refers to a statement there, Hakol l'fi rov ha-masa, that everything is assessed based on the magnitude of the action, or really the multitude is how it should be translated, harov hamasa, the multitude of the action. And the Rambam explains that we look at how many times an action is repeated, and he considers the question of if one has to decide how to allocate his charitable funds, and he could give $100 in one lump sum, or he could give the same $100 with the same result, but he could give it as 10 $10 gifts, better to do it the second way, even though it's going to have the same impact. The same $100 will be transmitted to the needy, but if he has to do it through 10 gifts, if he has to reach into his pocket 10 times, he has to write out a check 10 times, 10 acts of generosity, that is going to have an effect on his soul 10 times. It's going to have that impact 10 times as much, and it's worth it for that reason. So even though the effect it has on others is the same either way, you have to also pay attention to what it does to you, to the giver, and that's a part of pursuing this character transformation, this search for divinity. And what Avram was doing is the same thing, apparently, that the Rambam is talking about here. So this search for character development, for personal growth, through this kind of behavior, what exactly is the character trait that we're looking for? So today, it is very popular to talk about empathy. And empathy, broadly defined, there are many definitions, but broadly defined for our purposes, we will describe it as identifying with the needs and the feelings and the emotions of others. This is a topic that's been discussed for a long time, even though the word hasn't been around for so long. But it was discussed, for example, by the Scottish philosophers in the 1700s, David Hume and Adam Smith. They were pushing back against what they called the selfish hypothesis, against the idea that man could only be motivated by pursuing his own needs. And Hume and Smith talked about what they called sympathy, what we would today call empathy, but the word didn't exist yet. And they talked about it in different ways. Hume referred to what we would really call mirroring, about a kind of automatic connection to what you would witness in somebody else's experiences. And Adam Smith took it a little bit further, about an active decision to put yourself in somebody else's position. And then more recently, only about 100 years ago, in the early 1900s, the word empathy came into use, really from the German Einfühlung, which means to feel into. And the notion became popular that this type of experiencing what somebody else is going through was very crucial to moral development. And I should acknowledge that there are many different usages of the word, and we can't always necessarily get it exactly accurate because of these different usages, but broadly speaking, some kind of experiencing what others are going through, this became perceived as very central to moral development. And one of the main advocates of this position is a researcher named C. Daniel Batson, who advocated what he called the empathy altruism theory, that it's necessary to feel empathy in order to be motivated to do anything on behalf of anyone else. He happened to define empathy very broadly, all the different feelings that one has in concern for what others are going through. And he conducted studies where he felt he was able to chart that there's a difference between simply feeling distress at seeing others suffering and actually caring about the fact that they were suffering. And that if one had the choice of either escaping, witnessing somebody else's problems, or actually doing something about it when that actually took greater effort, that those who simply felt distress, they would run away, while those who actually cared would go to the greater effort of actually doing about it. And he claimed he could document this. Others disputed the feelings, but this was a big part of what he documented as the empathy altruism hypothesis, that it was crucial to feel empathy in order to be motivated to act on behalf of others. And others, such as Martin Hoffman, understood or claimed that the roots of all morality could be found in empathy. And there were those who then connected this to biological factors. So in the early 1990s, there were researchers in Parma, in Italy, who claimed to have found in monkeys, and they assume this is true in humans also, what they call mirror neurons, that there are neurons in the brain that fire, normally should fire when the body is moving. But in this case, they fire when they see other monkeys doing something, and the assumption is they're connecting to what they're witnessing. They're feeling a part of what other monkeys are doing, and that presumably humans also can feel connected to what other humans are doing and experiencing, and they consider this to be a tremendous find. One prominent neurobiologist said that the mirror neurons will do for psychology what DNA did for biology. Still waiting, but perhaps it will have that kind of an impact, that this idea that we can see a direct connection between how one person can relate to another's experiences, this is going to be the key to all moral development. And more recently, another scientist, Paul Zak, wrote a book called The Moral Molecule, where he claims that it's oxytocin that allows people to feel a bond to each other, and that's going to be the key to all moral decisions, because being able to connect to other people's feelings is what makes everything go up and down. All morality is connected to that, because without that bond, nothing happens. I don't know, from a perspective of a belief in free will, how comfortable we would be tying it all into these alleged biological factors, or there's much controversy that surrounds these findings. But the idea that feeling some type of connection to the experiences and the emotions of others, what is broadly called empathy, certainly does have a strong rooting in our sources. And just to note some prominent examples, so to go to the earliest description of one of our greatest heroes, or perhaps our greatest hero in Jewish history, so let's look to Moshe Rabbeinu. So how is Moshe Rabbeinu described at the very beginning of his story? The earliest description of Moshe Rabbeinu, one of the first things that we hear about Moshe is that he is raised in the house of Paro, that he is isolated from all of the suffering of the Jewish people. But nonetheless, he grows up, and the Torah tells us, Vayetze Elechav, that he goes out, Vayar B'Sivlosam. And he looks, he sees their suffering. And there's a fascinating comment that Rashi makes. What does Rashi say over there? That Vayar, what does it mean? He saw their suffering. Nasan Eina V'Libo Lios Meitzar. Right, that he set his eyes and his heart to anguish over what they were going through. So that is what would be called at that point probably cognitive and affective empathy, that he set his eyes to see, to understand what they were going through, and also his heart, that he should feel it as well. And if you look at some of the later commentaries, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman over there notes that the pasuk says Vayar twice. And he understands that first Vayar, he saw, and he writes there that that means he contemplated, he tried to really see what was going on and internalize it. And then Vayar again, he looked the second time with this newfound understanding of what the suffering meant so that he could really relate to it. Again, a description of what would be called cognitive empathy, of trying to understand the suffering around him. And the Oznaim L'Torah, the Lutzke Rav, has another level of interpretation there. He says that Vayar, in that sense, he quotes a pasuk in Koheles, that Vayar there should mean understanding, that he understood, again, cognitive empathy. But then he goes on to say that it was a hishtatfus gemura, a complete partnership, a complete joining of their experience, which would be called perhaps affective or emotional empathy, a joining in what was going on. And this is how Moshe Rabbeinu is described in essentially the first steps of his path towards leadership. And Rav Yonasan Eibshitz, in fact, had a fascinating comment. We know that the tribe of Levi, where Moshe came from, was not a part of the slavery, was excluded from the Shibud. And he explains, Rav Yonasan Eibshitz, that Paro's fortune tellers told him that we foresee that the savior of the Jewish people is going to come from the tribe of Levi. So we advise that you should exclude them from the Shibud, and that way they won't care. They won't be a part of the suffering, and maybe that will set the plan off course. The savior is not going to worry about it because he's not going to be a part of the experience. And they underestimated this power of empathy that Moshe Rabbeinu had, that even though he wasn't a part of that experience, he was able to put himself in their shoes and to identify with this active process that these Mefarshim are referring to in the Pasuk, and to identify with their suffering, to feel that empathy, and to decide he was going to do something about it, to be motivated to do something about it. And this is not only part of the description of Moshe Rabbeinu, but this is one of the attributes of God that is described at that time, that God tells Moshe, it's one of the names of God, Eka, Asher Eka, I will be where I will be, and Chazal tell us I will be with them at that time, I will be with them in their future suffering. So the notion of being with those who are suffering is one of the attributes of God, and we are told, of course, to imitate his attributes. And in the context, specifically, of the mitzvah of staka, so we find that the Torah says that not only are we commanded to open our hands and give to those who are poor, but the Torah surrounds that also with verses of prohibition, that we're not allowed to clench our fist or to harden our hearts when we are approached. And there's a range of interpretations, but the Rambam understands that to mean that there's a specific commandment relating to our compassion and empathy, that we can't turn off our emotional connection to those who are suffering and those who are in need. And separate from the obligation to give, we also have to feel the empathy for their need. And there's a fascinating comment of the Ksav Sofer, writing in the 1800s, who notes that the commandment to loan money, which is connected to the commandment to give charity, is phrased in an unusual way. It's phrased as if it's optional, even though it's obligatory. And he suggests, the Ksav Sofer, that it's meant to convey that we are supposed to specifically connect and to empathize, to join in the suffering of those who are in need, so that we feel motivated to give because we want to, as if it is a voluntary act, even though it is actually a commandment. And that's why the Torah phrases it that way, in order to send that message that is supposed to come from this internal feeling of connection. And on top of that, not only is empathy presented as a motivation, but it's also an end in of itself, just as we find in all areas of life. So, for example, you go to the doctor, you don't only want that the doctor should take good care of you and should cure your problems, but you also want to see that he cares. You want to feel the empathy, and that's a part of how you will rate the experience. You want to perceive that as an end in and of itself. And we find that also in halacha. The Talmud tells us, the Gemara says in Nedarim, that a part of this mitzvah of Bikur Cholim, part of what God modeled when he visited Avram, is that there should be there to experience the problem together with the patient. That is an end in and of itself. And the Talmud says that the visitor takes away a part of the illness of the patient. And the Gemara says specifically, not everyone can do this, but specifically a visitor who is a Ben Gilo. What does that mean to be a Ben Gilo? The more famous interpretation is something mystical sounding. You have to share the mazel of the patient. But other interpretations are it's simply a commonality. If there's some kind of a common base between the visitor and the patient, maybe they're the same age group or the same temperament, but there's something that allows them to create a bond, so that has an actual effect. And the patient will recover quicker or will be alleviated to some degree because of that bond. So we find that empathy is certainly present in our halachic sources, in our hashgafic sources, both as a motivational force, as a part of the mitzvah of staka, and as an end in and of itself. And it's certainly reasonable to theorize that Avram Avinu is working to develop that attribute even when there aren't actual human recipients of his charity and of his hospitality, and that the Rambam is advocating cultivating that attribute. And it could be that all of that is actually even reflected in contemporary science. A few books talk about studies that have shown that you can enhance empathy through virtual reality, through pretending that you are actually taking care of real people, even if you aren't. Not much different than taking care of angels. And very similar to Avram's experience, the studies that are reflected in the writings of Abigail Marsh and others, that they have shown that there are lasting effects from virtual reality experiences, that empathy actually has been improved through those tests, which is a fascinating concept and perhaps reflective of what's displayed there. So there is quite a lot to be said for empathy and its support within our sources. And yet, At the same time, there's been some degree of pushback against empathy. And in fact, there's actually a book with that title, Against Empathy, written by a professor at Yale, Paul Bloom. And this book, Against Empathy, is not some kind of ruthless capitalist manifesto arguing against charity or against helping others. It's actually subtitled The Case for Rational Compassion. And it's arguing that empathy can actually do a lot of harm. And even if you think that maybe this is the work of a cynic contrarian, maybe to some degree it is, he's not alone. There's another recent book, my son actually read this at MTA, a book called Humankind by Rutger Bregman, and he's very far from a cynic. That book is subtitled A Hopeful History, and if you read the book, it's actually quite fascinating. So he discusses just about every study, many well-known studies, that have cast a negative light on human nature, and he essentially redoes all of them to present them much more positively and optimistically and in a much more hopeful light. And yet, he writes there, has a whole chapter called How Empathy Blinds Us. And he essentially writes that empathy is the cause of all the world's problems. And he has a line there that one thing is certain, a better world does not start with empathy. And there is a movement that argues that empathy is very much unhelpful to productive decisions or to benefiting the world. So what would be the problem with empathy? Why would there be such arguments and such literature coming forward claiming that we're not necessarily gaining from all of this celebration of empathy? Well, there are a few problems. A part of it is that empathy is limited. Our emotional capacity is not infinite. There's a quote that's attributed to Stalin, which may or may not actually have been said by him, but that one death is a tragedy and a million deaths is a statistic, that we eventually run out of our capacity to care. Probably more accurately, the economist Thomas Schelling referred to the identifiable victim effect, that we only are able to care about those who we can point to and identify, and when it becomes a million, when it becomes 100,000, then we lose our ability to care. The philosopher Jesse Prince, talked about the cuteness effect, that we tend to empathize with those that we find attractive or cute or appealing, but those that are less so, and we don't necessarily care about. Even some of the great advocates of empathy, Martin Hoffman, talk about the here and now effect or the availability effect. We're able to care more about those that are here that we see, but those that are less so, we don't necessarily care about as much. Or others talk about simply the fact that empathy may not be as strong a motivation as other factors. And more seriously, it can sometimes cause us to take the wrong side and can work against forces of justice and fairness. And even the great advocate Daniel Batson has noted through his studies that high empathy individuals often tend to favor the targets of their empathy at the expense of others. And we know that there are psukim in the Torah in the context of justice that forbid us from empathizing at times. And in the context specifically of tzedakah, we have a number of areas, a number of rules, which seem to push us away sometimes from empathetic concerns. Just to mention three, we have an obligation to make sure that the recipients of tzedakah are actually legitimate and deserving. There's a debate, a conflict in some sources as to whether there's any mitzvah at all if one gives tzedakah to those who may not really be deserving, may not be genuine. There's a statement in the Talmud in Ksubis which sounds cynical but reflects genuine realities. The Gemara says, "Bo nachzik tov l'ramayim," that we should be grateful for the hoaxsters, for the fraudsters, because they save us from being guilty. We can blame our lack of generosity on them. We don't give to anybody because we don't know who to trust. But it's a reality that there are those who are false and insincere, and we may not fulfill any mitzvah of tzedakah in giving to them. And even if there is a fulfillment, so that may apply only to those who are giving from their personal funds, but certainly those who are managing public funds donated to by others have a much greater responsibility to make sure that the recipients are worthy, and if they are guided only by their empathy, will make very serious mistakes. In addition, there is also a list of priorities when it comes to tzedakah, which has very serious weight within halacha. So we talk, for example, of the principle of aniya ircha kodmim, that there must be attention paid first to those who are closest to you, whether geographically or familially or otherwise, and that sometimes must override pulls of emotion or empathy or other types of concern. And once again, that impacts decisions in a different way. There's also sometimes a limit that a person of average income is only permitted to give a chomesh, is only permitted to give a fifth. Otherwise, they themselves may become dependent on tzedakah, limited in their own ability to continue to be generous, even though their emotional pull may say, I want to give away everything. And that itself is, once again, an area where their empathetic desires may lead them to make decisions that contradict halacha. And then there is also the demands, that's now popularized as the effective altruism movement, but halacha recognizes that to some extent as well. It's interesting to note that there are even those who disagreed with the Rambam when the Rambam said that you should prioritize the spiritual growth of the donor in your decisions to tzedakah. There were those who took issue with that, notably Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who died in 1776. That's how you can remember when the revolution was. So he wrote that he thought the Rambam was wrong. He said that we should prioritize the impact when making decisions how to give out tzedakah. And he said that even if you are looking to affect your personality, you'll affect your personality more by having a bigger impact with your donation. When you see that you're going to affect people's lives more, that will have a greater sense of accomplishment, and that should guide your decisions. So there is much on the other side of the equation. However, it's still a balance. And these prohibitions that we mentioned before that surround the obligation to give tzedakah, that tell us not to harden our heart or to clench our fist, they loom large. It's scary, the idea that one can violate a prohibition or two prohibitions when they decline to give tzedakah. And it's a discussion in the poskim, how exactly do you navigate that? If somebody asks you and you say no, are you indeed violating two Torah prohibitions? And there are those who suggest that maybe the Torah is being literal when it says that kind of language. Don't harden your heart, don't clench your fist. So it all depends on the attitude. If somebody asks you for tzedakah and you say, listen, I would love to give you and my heart is breaking for you, but there's only so much I can give and I have priorities that are close to me that I have to take care of also, and I have a responsibility to make sure that my money is allocated wisely, so I need to pay more attention to that. My heart is breaking for you. So then perhaps you're not in violation of these prohibitions. But if when you decline, you say, listen, you're not my problem, I don't care, work for it yourself, I don't have any obligation, so then you would be in violation of these prohibitions. But the Torah is telling us that we have to balance maintaining the concern and the empathy with the rationality at the same time. And we also have to recognize that intellectualism can only take us so far, as much as it's necessary. One of Daniel Batson's more widely cited studies was conducted at the Princeton Theological Seminary, where he tested seminarians. He told them that they have to go give a lecture, they have to go give the sermon on the other side of the seminary, and that they're late, they have to run, they have to get to the other side over there. And he hired actors along the way to be in obvious distress to see if they would stop to take care of them while they were running to give the lecture that they were late for. And many of them did not stop. And what was the topic of the lecture they were supposed to give? Stopping to take care of people who are in need. So intellectualism can only take you so far. So you need the emotional component to some extent. And that's a part of the balance that's always going to be there. And that's always necessary. And that's a part of the challenge. So somehow they have to come together. And that's a part of what we work with and what we acknowledge. We are here in one of the great kehillos, one of the great congregations in New Jersey. 100 years ago, one of the great congregations in New Jersey was Hoboken, believe it or not. And one of the very well-known rabbanim in New Jersey at that time was Rav Chaim Hirschenson, who wrote many fascinating svarim. And he talked there about the fact that this balance is very challenging. And he wrote a sefer on Horios, where the Talmud talks about the different priorities that have to be invoked in life-saving. And he talked about the fact that there are challenges that require sometimes balancing the heart and the head and the logic and the emotion. And he referred to some of these sources that talk about these challenges. And he noted that on the one hand, the Talmud says in Bava Metzia that we do have to take the policy of your needs come first, that if your property is lost and somebody else's property is lost, so shalcha kodem lechavercha, that which is yours has to take priority before you take care of somebody else's property. But at the same time, the Talmud does say that hamakayim atzmo b'kach sofo lo v'ledekach, that whoever is too precise, too exacting in that rule and worrying about his own needs first will ultimately forget about the whole idea of chesed, and as a consequence, he'll end up needing to be the recipient of other people's charity. And essentially reflecting the idea that, yes, logic has to rule, that we have to have rational rules, but if we totally become disconnected from the emotional, empathetic side, so then we can forget about chesed completely, and that's certainly not going to be the kind of people that we want to be. And he commented as well on the more well-known passage in the Talmud in Bava Metzia, where the Gemara talks about the debate between Ben Petura and Rabbi Akiva about somebody who is traveling in the desert and he has only one bottle of water and only he or his partner in travels can survive. And Ben Petura said, well, better they should split it so that this one shouldn't have to see his co-traveler die, and then they'll both die. And Rabbi Akiva said, you have to worry about your own life first. Even though it was the same Rabbi Akiva who said that the key principle in life is v'ahav t'l'recha kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, feel that empathy, care about the other, but still there has to be a logical system that surrounds all of that, and ultimately you have to worry about yourself first. But at the same time, Ben Petura was reflecting that emotional need that has to be there, but they balance each other out, and they're both present in humanity, and if we forget about one, we forget about the other, so then we're not going to have a system, and they're both included in our Talmud, even if ultimately there has to be a system that regulates how we behave, we recognize that the empathy and the emotion is always going to be a part of how we think and how we analyze. So ultimately, what does that mean for us? So that means that it's perhaps different than what we say about everything else. When we talk about money, for example, so we say sometimes that the problem is we see money as the end, when really it should be the means to an end. It should be something that we use to serve God, something that we use as a tool rather than an end of itself. And here, when we talk about empathy, maybe we should say it the other way around, that we use empathy sometimes as a means to an end, as a way to make decisions. But really, it's actually an end of it itself. It has inherent value. But as a way to make decisions, it is a little bit flawed. It is a little bit unreliable. And we need sometimes to have more rational-based decisions and to recognize that we make decisions in chesed because of halachta b'drachav, because we are following God's path. And empathy is a part of decision-making. We can't be like Sam Bloom against empathy and say that we reject the whole thing, because it's a key part of what makes us human and what connects us to God's path. But it's not a perfect way to completely assess the whole situation. So it's more of an end than a means, the opposite of other things. But it's also an assistant part of our system. And perhaps it's comparable to Ahava and Yira, as we talk about in Elul, that a Yira, reverence for God, is a crucial part of how we serve God. But ultimately, we look for Ahava as the more positive overall motivational force. And both of them are necessary. Both of them are crucial parts of how we relate to God. But ultimately, Ahava becomes the overarching guiding theme. And there's a fascinating point to consider, that this new year that we are about to bring in with this Rosh Hashanah is a leap year. We're going to add an extra month. It's going to be a very long year, especially for those in college who are going to have to wait a very long time for their Pesach vacation. So why is that? Why are we adding an extra month? It's a mitzvah from the Torah. The Torah obligates us to add an extra month. Shamor is Chodesh Aviv. We have to make sure that Pesach is always in the springtime. It's a mitzvah from the Torah. So therefore, we have to add an extra month because the way our calendar works, which is based on the moon rather than the sun, so our combination. So if we don't add an extra month every once in a while, it's going to fall out of sync with the seasons and Pesach won't be in the springtime. So we have to add an extra month every once in a while to keep Pesach in the springtime. That's the reason for the leap year. Why is it so important that Pesach be in the springtime? Medrash tells us that God declared, Ru'u chesed shegamaltem. Look at the chesed that I did for you. I took you out of Egypt at a time that wasn't too hot and wasn't too cold. The perfect time. I took you out of Egypt in the springtime. Remember that Shemor is Chodesh Aviv. Pesach should always be in the springtime. It's very hard to understand. So imagine here, you've been brutally enslaved for hundreds of years. Good news! You're going to be released in January. Ooh, I can't do winter. I'm not interested. Okay, fine. You'll be released in July. Summer, I can't do that either. April? Yes, I'll take April. We'll be released in April. Would we have turned down the Exodus if it had been in the winter or the summer? What's the idea of saying that we have to memorialize specifically that Pesach is in the springtime? And that is crucial, and it is a mitzvah min HaTorah. We must always remember, Pesach must always be in the springtime. Ru'u chesed, you have to always remember this chesed that God took us out of Egypt when the weather was nice. And my Rabbi, the Rosh Yeshiva of Karen B'Yavne, of Golvich, Zichrono Livracha, explained that there is a concept of chesed and there's a concept of rachmanis. There are two separate midos, the two separate qualities. The descendants of Avraham Avinu are identified both as being rachmanim and gomlei chasadim. It's two separate ideas. It's one thing to feel compassion when someone is collapsing in front of you, when someone is starving and obviously needs some food and some relief, and they're crying and you can't turn away. That's the rachmanis. It's a whole other quality to be able to say that even when there's no shrieking, when no one's calling out, when there's no blatant, undeniable need in front of me, but still, how can I make things better? How can I be giving even when there's no outcry? That's what it means to be of chesed. At the very origin of the Jewish people, God made sure that we remembered that we are not only rachmanim, as crucial and as vital as that is, but we are also gomlei chasadim. That for sure we are responsive to the cry of those who are suffering and those who are miserable. And we are also, by our very nature, giving and providing for those who are not so obviously in need. Because giving by itself is an attribute of God and is goodness by its very nature. And that will also direct our decisions. We will be there for those who are suffering, and we will also be giving because that is the essence of God. And both of those must be there together. This coming Motzei Shabbos, those of us who are Ashkenazim, who haven't started Slichos yet, will start Slichos. And we will invoke the 13 attributes of Rachamim, Yud Gimel Midos HaRachamim. And we are told that when we look for God's forgiveness, that we should invoke these 13 midos, and some understand that the statement of the Talmud, Ye'asu Lufanai, means not only we should say them, but that we should seek to live them. And we understand that there are 13 attributes, that Rachmanis is nuanced and complex and more than we can understand, that it's not one thing and that it's made up of so many different components, and that in order to emulate God, there's a lot that we have to try to understand and incorporate and bring in to what it means to be a giving person, to be characters of chesed, to truly emulate everything that God has modeled for us and asked us to be. But if we are successful in doing so, if we are able to truly give empathy its proper place, to give rachmanis its context, together with everything chesed should mean, then we should be privileged and we should be blessed that the greatest challenge we should have is figuring out how to allocate and share all the blessings that God bestows upon us. Thank you very much. Maybe just to quickly review what we spoke about. So we tried to figure out a little bit what Avram was doing in taking care of people who were not actually people. We talked about the Rambam's idea that it's worthwhile doing things even if it just helps you because it creates a midah. We talked about the idea of empathy being highlighted as a value and being understood as the key moral motivator. We talked about the fact that there's been some dispute about that. And we talked about, in halachic sources, we certainly find empathy highlighted. We find Moshe Rabbeinu valued for his empathy and displaying what seems like cognitive empathy and affective empathy, both understanding and feeling. We talked about how that was a part of tzedaka and the Ksav Sofer's idea that's the key motivator in terms of tzedaka. We talked about how it's an end in and of itself also, what we find in Bikur Cholim, but we talked about also how emulating that might be its value in and of itself, and we talked about how sort of experiments in virtual reality that seem to echo this whole idea in modern science. And then we talked about some of the pushback and some of the problems that empathy have been identified with and how they may mislead us in terms of some of our decisions, sometimes in small ways, sometimes in bigger ways. We talked about sometimes how the halacha requires decisions that may not necessarily comport with empathy. We talked about such decisions as tzedaka requiring aniyei ircha, requiring making sure that the recipients are actually deserving, making sure that we don't give beyond our own limits. Then we talked about various other balances that require paying attention to the two. And we suggested that maybe empathy, instead of being a means to an end, should be an end in itself because of its inherent value, should also be a means, but a means that is balanced together with more rationality because it's not necessarily completely reliable. And then we talked about that idea that maybe Avram Avinu was essentially modeling that type of chesed that is value in and of itself, even when you're not necessarily looking to help somebody who's suffering, and that is his greatness, and that we are seeking to model that behavior of HaKadosh Baruch Hu with Yud Gimel Midos HaRachamim that we will start reciting this Motzei Shabbos, and that should be his blessing for us. Wish everyone a wonderful year.